That's Young Turk. Etta James with Bob Dylan's Gotta Serve Somebody, which he released in 1979. It's the number one track, though, on Etta James's December 2000 album, titled after her moniker, Etta James, Matriarch of the Blues. Etta James, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993, the Blues Hall of Fame in 2001, and the Grammy Hall of Fame, both in 1999 and 2008, died in Riverside, California, on January the 20th, 2012, due to complications from leukemia. She was 74 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and what an interesting program we have for you today. In the second half of the program, we'll discuss the FBI's incredibly well-timed decision today, just announced, that there's no reason to indict Hillary Clinton for anything because she hasn't committed a crime. And this is with respect to the email debacle. But first, we want to talk about that incredible development over the weekend involving Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, starting with Uganda, where 40 years ago his older brother Yonatan was killed in an Israeli Defense Force-led commando raid on the airport at Entebbe to free hostages being held by pro-Palestinian hijackers. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday began a foray into East Africa that also will include scheduled trips to Kenya, Rwanda, and Ethiopia, and includes summit meetings with leaders from South Sudan, Tanzania, and Zambia. Netanyahu said that his trip to the region, the first in 30 years by an Israeli prime minister, is meant to indicate a renewed interest in forging bilateral economic and strategic ties with old friends. But new fears and suspicions abound in the African world about Israel's ramped-up foreign policy push on the continent. We are fortunate to have with us today Abayomi Azikiwe, editor-in-chief of Pan-African Newswire, who will be discussing this trip and the significance of it. Thanks, Abayomi, for being with us today. Let's hear, first of all, I want to get us prepped here, and I want to share with you an interview that Benjamin Netanyahu gave. I called it an interview, but it's a short brief exchange with Daniel Kalinaki. He is the regional editor with Nation Media Group, which happens to be the largest media conglomerate in East and Central Africa. He was talking with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on the cusp of this trip. Here's what the exchange was all about.
Mr. Prime Minister, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to speak to you.
My pleasure.
You said Israel is coming back to Africa and Africa is coming back to Israel. You've been a player for many years now as Prime Minister, and Africa is a place that has special importance to you personally. Why has it taken so long and why now?
It's too long, and it's about time, and it's even overdue. But I'm glad to have the opportunity as Prime Minister to correct that deficiency. I think part of the reason was that Israel was blacklisted, is the right word I would use, in Africa. It was basically kicked out by political pressures from many, many countries in which we were active in the 60s and into the 70s. And it took a while for things to change. I think the thing that changed most was something outside of Africa. Well, one or two African countries too were Arab states. The Arab world changed. It hasn't changed formally, but it's changed informally, in that many Arab countries now understand that Israel is not their enemy, but their partner in fighting militant Islamist terror that threatens just about every country in the region, and many, many countries in Africa. And equally, many Many African countries recognize that. So what the Arabs, many of the Arab states now understand, certainly many African countries grasp as well. And they also, I think, understand another thing, that Israel could be their partner, not merely in the areas of security, but first and foremost in the areas of development. Israel has also changed over the years and became a world power in innovation, in water management, in health, in agriculture, in just about every area of life that is important for the well-being and prosperity of the people of Africa. So when you have these two things finally congeal, a general political change in the world and in our region, in the Middle East, and the growing needs of security and development, Israel is a natural partner. And therefore, I've always wanted to come back to have Israel come back to Africa, but I think what has changed now is that many African countries want Africa to come back to Israel. And it's happening now, and I'm delighted. I'm very excited.
You talk about a country of diversity, a country that represents many people. Yet some of your critics say that Israel's attitude towards migration, towards people seeking refuge, in particular people from Eritrea and Sudan, has been rather dubious. They point to the fact that, for instance, you've given asylum to only 4 out of 33,000 Eritreans, 1 out of 8,500 Sudanese. How should Israel, a country built by refugees, for refugees, a country that basically said those who need shelter, who need somewhere to go, how should it respond to people who are fleeing conflict and persecution in other areas?
Well, look, the people who came here in very large numbers were job immigrants. They were healthy young men, typically in their early 20s, and they were not refugees. We've taken in people that we felt, our own brethren, the Jews of Ethiopia. We brought them in by the many thousands, as you know. There are 100,000 Ethiopian Jews in Israel.
Security is obviously a big area where Africa can work with Israel. But you've also said that you like to see African countries change the way they vote at the UN. How much of this thrust to Africa is really to shore up the numbers of the votes in the UN?
You know, the UN Human Rights Council, I'll just give you how absurd this is. The UN Human Rights Council, okay, passes every year more resolutions against the democracy of Israel in the heart of this turbulent region of the Middle East than all the other countries combined, including North Korea, including Iran, including Syria. It's absurd. So why not correct this absurdity? Why not have a more balanced and equitable reflection of the truth and B, of fairness in international forums? And yes, of course I seek that. I'm quite open about it. But equally I seek those bilateral ties with so many states. Why not have with Africa what we have now with the countries of Asia? And frankly, with quite a few countries in the Middle East. I think it makes sense in every way that you look at it, bilaterally, multilaterally. And I'm very excited about this visit. It's very emotional for me, too, to come to Entebbe. It's very emotional for me because this is the place where my brother was cut down and died at the age of 30 while leading a rescue force to free the hostages held by Arab terrorists in Entebbe Airport. I regret that I could never get my parents, my late father, who was a great historian, when President Museveni invited me and my family to come. It was very kind and had a very moving ceremony conducted by Ugandan soldiers for the fallen soldier. I wanted my father to be there, but I thought that he might not survive the emotion that I felt. He was in his 90s at the time. So he didn't come there, but I felt a tremendous emotion, sadness too, but also a closing of the circle. My brother landed in the pitch of darkness to save our citizens, And here I come to Africa, a different government, a different relationship, in broad daylight, being welcomed by the president of Uganda. There'll be other African leaders there. It's both important for us on the national and international level, but for me, it's a personal journey of the deepest sentiment. So I'm very emotional about this visit.
Should we expect any concrete cooperation on terrorism and security with East Africa in particular?
Yes.
But what advice do you give African countries dealing with either migration or internal terrorism?
If they ask me, in the meeting with the leaders, I'll give them my advice. But I've learned over a few decades as both a diplomat at the UN and then as foreign minister and now fourth term as prime minister, give your advice directly to the leaders, not always in front of TV. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Brief interview given by Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, with Daniel Kalinaki of the Nation Media Group on the occasion of his historic visit to East Africa, specifically starting out in Uganda, but expecting to also take in Kenya, Rwanda, and Ethiopia, and having summit meetings also with the leaders of South Sudan, Tanzania, and Zambia. Our guest is Abayomi Azikiwe. He is the editor-in-chief of Pan-African Newswire. Abayomi, what do you make of the Prime Minister's visit?
I believe it's an effort by the State of Israel to develop new markets in Africa, to test the waters in regard to African Union member states and their attitudes towards relations with the State of Israel. I think there are serious issues involved in this whole process, as was asked Prime Minister Netanyahu by the Nation correspondent, the issue about migrants, African migrants in Israel. Now, he refused to give a direct answer to this question, but there are tens of thousands of African migrants from Eritrea, from South Sudan, as well as Uganda, who are under extreme pressure by the Israeli security forces and by the Israeli government itself. Even the prime minister in the Knesset a couple of years ago referred to these migrants as, quote, infiltrators, unquote. I mean, these people have been attacked on the street by mobs. Their businesses that they've set up in Tel Aviv and other areas have been attacked, vandalized, looted, and set on fire. They've built a fence between Egypt and the Palestine land, the State of Israel. And they have built a specific prison, particularly to house African migrants who are coming and leaving the State of Israel. So I think he needs to give a clear answer to this question. And there are many other issues. Why has there been strained relations between the State of Israel and various African states? The Palestinian question, which he did not address either, still pending. The Palestinian people are an oppressed people. They have been waging a national liberation struggle, as many states and peoples and cultures in Africa have been doing for decades. So this is the connection, the solidarity between the Palestinians, between various progressives and nationalist Arab states and progressive and even moderate forces on the African continent. So I don't think he's being forthright in saying that, you know, the African states have been somehow misled about the character of the State of Israel in the past. But there are many issues that Israel has to answer to on a contemporary basis as well.
Well, it was interesting yesterday that President Yoweri Museveni, the Ugandan president, in making a speech greeting Netanyahu at the airport, kept referring to Israel as the Holy Land, Israel-Palestine. He kept saying Israel-Palestine. Does that indicate to you that although there is this reception of the Netanyahu, there's still some reservation and people are still a little antsy, or is this just pure politics going on?
I believe that, African people are very welcoming people and very diplomatic people. If you want to go and meet, people will meet with you. They will greet you. They will treat you with respect. But it doesn't mean necessarily that the other issues are not being taken into consideration, particularly on a mass level. We're talking about state-to-state relations in this instance. But in terms of the grassroots people in Uganda and other countries, even in Ethiopia and South Sudan, where he's going to be having a summit meeting with leaders of South Sudan and Zambia, and also visiting Ethiopia, where he's going to speak before the parliament, does not mean that these other issues remain unresolved. And I think another factor in all of this, of course, is the turmoil that we see now in the European Union in the aftermath of the Brexit vote. There's a lot of uncertainty in regard to trade agreements and economic as well as political relations between the European Union member states, the UK, and African Union member states. I believe the state of Israel sees this as a potential opening for them to step in amid this period of uncertainty and negotiations in regard to the exit of Britain from the European Union, and taking advantage of the growing markets in Africa. Israel is heavily subsidized by the United States, both militarily and also in regard to technology. And they have factories and other production facilities there that produced technological products that they want to market to the African continent that deal heavily with security, national security concerns. So I believe these are issues that the Netanyahu government sees the capacity or the ability to exploit. If you notice, recently they've had discussions with the government in Turkey, which had the relation between Turkey and Israel had been strained since 2010 when they raided a Turkish aid ship and killed numerous people. The Turkish ship was only going to transport assistance to the Palestinians in Gaza, who were under siege. It happened under siege for many years. So I think it's a diplomatic offensive on the part of the Israeli government. Whatever Middle Eastern states or Arab states that they can possibly reopen dialogue with and set up relationships with provides an opening for them in light of this type of confusion that's going on right now as it relates to the European Union and even the United States. I mean, this is an election year in the States. There's a lot of uncertainty here as well. And I think they're attempting to maneuver and try to take advantage of the, situation that's highly fluid right now internationally.
But we also should look at the context here, and that being this history of the relationship between Israel and African states and the African continent as a whole. The Prime Minister prefers to call them bilateral ties, but I think on review, there isn't very much bi in the bilateral ties. When you can literally invade a country and you are in a position of selling arms to it, which was the reason that Idi Amin, the then president of Uganda, had thought he was going to get support, military support, from Israel, and he was going to be able to buy weapons if only to conduct his own atrocities. But it didn't turn out that way. But Israel has not had a very, should I say, a laudatory history of bilateral policies with African states. We have the glaring question of South Africa still not even mentioned, the role Israel played in fostering and maintaining one of the most treacherous and genocidal systems there called apartheid, the role Israel has played in subverting democracy in many African states, using black African states in order to keep Arab states closer to home at bay. I see still in the conversation, that brief conversation that Benjamin Netanyahu had with the correspondent from Nation Media Group, Daniel Kalinaki, there's still the attitude that we see Africa as a place essentially of great benefit to us, not necessarily on a bilateral basis, although he does say that, but it is hard to figure out what the bilateral part would be. I could see that Israel would have access to more land, for example, to be able to grow its own crops externally and bring them back home because they're running out of space in Palestine to having to devote all these newly acquired lands to settlements, illegal settlements. They can't possibly continue their expansion and feed themselves at the same time. So they're looking for places to grow their own crops and also to establish some sort of external source of revenue. And hence you have this reference to technical and technological development, water management, and other things. But Israel has also been very, very famous for setting up shadow initiatives. On the one hand, it looks like it is about development. On the other hand, it is a kind of it's an incipient move into gaining new turf in new ground, in new areas, in order to strategically hem in, if you will, the Arabs or the Arab enemies that it sees all around. So Africa seems to be a very strategic place to begin to expand at this time as well, since terrorist groups even have expanded their operations, and Africa looks like the next big bastion of a counteroffensive.
Yes, you raise a number of very important issues. If you look at the history of the World Zionist Movement, going back to the late 19th century, the early 20th century, people such as Theodore Herzl and Chaim Weizmann. In the early phase of the movement, they were looking not only to Palestine as a possible home for the Jewish people, but they also looked at various areas in Africa, for example, Uganda, where he's visiting now. That was proposed in the early phase of the Zionist movement as a possible homeland for the Jewish people, the European Jewish people. They also looked at Madagascar, which is in the Indian Ocean. And they also looked at Libya, which now has been overthrown and is a source of instability throughout not only North and West Africa, but also the Mediterranean states. And its influx and its instability has fostered divisions even within the European Union, straight across the board. Also, if we look at the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. There were, of course, wars that were waged in 1948. Later in 1956, when Israel, along with Britain and France, invaded Egypt, when Nasser, Gamal Abdel Nasser, the then president, nationalized the Suez Canal. And the only way in which this was halted was because the U.S. viewed it as an effort by British imperialism to reestablish its dominance in the Middle East and in North Africa in the aftermath of World War II, where the U.S. became the unquestionable dominant imperialist power. Then, of course, we can look at 1967, where they took land in the Sinai, in the Golan Heights, and also land from Jordan on the West Bank. And, of course, in 1973, when the Egyptian government under Sadat attempted to take back land in the Sinai, and, of course, it resulted in the Camp David Accords. But even today, in the Sinai, Israel is still taking natural gas to fuel energy needs in the state of Israel. And this, of course, is a point of consternation among a lot of people in Egypt as well. So this is a very long, well over 100 years, preoccupation and interest in the African continent on the part of the World Zionist Movement. And I think that people also need to understand, if you read the writings of Theodore Herzl and Kiam Weissman and the others, they wanted to set up a state for the European Jewish people in alliance with European colonialism and imperialism. They make it very clear that they would be an outpost of Western influence and dominance against a rising and encroaching Arab, Muslim, African, Asian population. And I think those imperatives on the part of the State of Israel, as well as the United States and European Union member states as well, is still with us today. You see the reaction to migration in Europe that has even caused this split within the ruling interests in Britain, where the Conservative Party is split, the Labour Party is split, the EU is in crisis. So these issues, which arose during the 19th century, are still very much with us today. And he cannot just dismiss this history of collaboration with the racist apartheid regime in South Africa, supplying them with weapons, technology, where they were able to develop nuclear capability in the old racist Republic of South Africa. So these are issues that are inevitably going to come up once again.
You mentioned earlier that the African leaders tend to be, or Africans tend to be very polite people and so forth.
Same thing with the Native Americans here.
But that aside, the fact is you can't but interpret this trip coming after more than 30 years and with a plane load of business people ready to sign contracts and ready to get down to making money and ready to basically recruit business and recruit people who will assist in the making of business. You can't but interpret this trip as a decision that has been made as part of a long-term policy by Netanyahu and by the Israeli government about the value of Africa. So the flip side of the coin is, what are the Africans thinking? Are they just being manly, or is it somebody is just not, they have let their guard down, or they are letting their guard down and looking more short-term than long-term?
Well, yes, we have to look at which governments, and we have to draw a distinction between these particular governments and the interests of the people on the ground inside these countries. I don't think it's an accident that he's gone to Uganda, because Uganda, on a military and intelligence level, has been very closely aligned with the United States in various geopolitical conflicts in Africa. Same situation exists now with Ethiopia, where Ethiopia has been involved in Somalia, and they have, of course, followed the U.S. Militarist and foreign policy imperatives throughout the African continent. Countries such as South Africa, Zimbabwe, and others have taken a more progressive position historically in relationship to the State of Israel. But it remains to be seen what he actually accomplishes. And there could be blowback within these various countries as it relates to Netanyahu's visit what his actual aims are. And a lot of these states themselves are in a very precarious situation right now because of not only the problems within the EU, but also objectively the United States under Obama. The volume of trade between the United States and Africa has dropped precipitously. Many people may not be aware of this. You know, I've written articles where I've discussed this. And, you know, despite the fact that many people in Africa had high hopes when he came into office 8 years ago, this has not resulted in any real economic boost for the continent. For example, in South Africa, they've had a running battle with the United States Department of Agriculture over the export of poultry products, which the South African government said did not meet their standards. And, of course, the U.S. was threatening to suspend them from the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And they just reached an agreement several months ago because they felt that the U.S. was dumping substandard poultry products on the market in South Africa. So these are problems that these African countries have in regard to markets, the marketing of their goods in the West, and the marketing of consumer goods from outside Africa into these various economies.
Well, we leave it there for the moment because this just happened yesterday.
Yeah.
And we just are making a note of it. And certainly we will be coming back to this discussion to talk about it more deeply when more information is obtained about what exactly is envisioned as the relationship between Israel and these African states that Benjamin Netanyahu has in mind to establish or to reestablish friendly ties and bilateral relations with. But I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for giving us some insight.
For the invitation, and I'm looking forward to hear your comments about the FBI press conference earlier today.
I tell you. Thanks so much, Abayomi. We'll talk again soon.
All right, thank you. All right, talk to you again.
All righty. Well, as you may know, because it's big news now, the FBI has apparently concluded its exhaustive examination into Hillary Clinton's email server and the alleged breach of protocol in using a private email server for transmitting information that also included classified information. What did the FBI find, it said? The FBI found that she was kind of careless. You know, she was a very careless lady in doing this, but no harm really done. And most importantly, there was no intent to evade scrutiny. She just did it, as she had explained herself. She did it because it was convenient, more convenient than anything else. So she was very, very careless, but that does not amount to a crime, certainly not a prosecutable crime. And it just so happens, you know, there's a thing about timing. I tell you, as they say in the show business, timing is everything. Well, what do we know? The timing here is everything. Because on this very day, your president, I'm giving him to you, he's my gift to you, I'm not claiming him by any means, your president is hitting the road today to begin to stump for Hillary Clinton. That's right. And on Friday, the vice president would be hitting the road to stump for her in his own hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania. So we have the number one guy in the country, the number two guy in the country. By the way, President Obama will be riding along. She'll be riding along with him, presumably at taxpayer expense. And the president will be doing campaigning work as a chief executive of this country. But we're not supposed to say anything. This does not appear to be wrong. As he arrives with Hillary Clinton in tow, to basically anoint her as the titular head of the Democratic Party, as the candidate of choice. She will be expected to basically embrace her nomination as the standard bearer for the party later this month when the party has its national convention. But of course, this is all coincidental. Just last week, we had President Clinton just so happened to run into the U.S. Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, on a private plane parked on a tarmac someplace in Phoenix, and they have a private conversation. Now, this is at the time that the Attorney General supposedly has Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, in the crosshairs for prosecution. They have a private conversation. Of course, nothing was wrong there. Nothing went wrong there. They weren't discussing business. They were talking, she said, about his grandchildren. Now, we're that stupid, they think. There's so much contempt for the people. This is what Loretta Lynch says, the highest law enforcement official in the country, who supposedly has an active investigation going on into the conduct of a former Secretary of State who is now a candidate for president. What puts all these people together is, again, politics. Now, if you, as an appointee of a Democratic president, the FBI director, James Comey, also is an appointee of the Democratic president. The Democratic president has made it clear that he supports Hillary Clinton, the presumptive heir to his throne when he leaves office next year. Who is going to go against that? They all fall in line. We get the message. The vice president, the Democratic vice president, is going stumping for you. The Democratic president is going stumping for you. It's a done deal. Hillary Clinton was assured that she was not going to be prosecuted. Simply just look at the logistics. It would never have been the case if otherwise she was going to be indicted that the president had already arranged to have her on his plane, US 1, going to make a campaign stop. This is how offensive these people are, to make a campaign stop in North Carolina to tell the world that you are supposed to be the next president of the United States. Come on. If, in fact, they didn't know how this thing was going to end, then that would not have been arranged. But they knew long ago how this thing was going to go. So they proceeded with their plans, and the plans continue. I point this out because on so many levels, this is offensive. And it should be the reason for reasonable people to say, you know what? I'm done. I'm done with this. We have not yet seen this level of open contempt for the American people. It's in your face that they don't care. And it's in your face that they're saying, not only are we doing what we want to do, you can't do a thing about it. You can't do a thing about it. It has been decided that Hillary Clinton will be the nominee and probably the next president. It has been decided. It was decided that she would be in the Senate. It was, despite all these investigations, The history of the Clintons is the history of wrongdoing, is the history of all kinds of shady business. It's the history of investigations that miraculously go nowhere. But people are trying to tell you that the process is impartial and fair. There is no fix here. There's no fix. She is just as pure as a driven snow. Well, you know, she's as pure as New York snow. And if anybody knows New York City snow, everybody knows what New York City snow is about. It ain't pure. That's for sure. But this is what we get. And nobody, for the sake of, quote, party unity, for the sake of winning at any cost, everybody shuts up and plays by those rules. The same people who stand up and rock themselves on their heels and grab their lapels and preach about morality and what's right are intimate actors in this chicanery, this effort to lie and deceive the people. And, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to put these things together. We're on the cusp of the national convention. We have a substandard candidate. Everything is telling us Hillary Clinton is not the gift they're telling us that she is. And she's not that popular or liked, well liked. All the polls are showing she is considered detestable to a large group of voters. They don't like her. And for good reason. She cannot be trusted. She is a profligate liar. It's been demonstrated time and again. But they have a system that protects them. We've been talking about the Clinton Global Initiative on this program and all the things, including massive deaths and killings attached to what she did as Secretary of State and failed to do as Secretary of State. We're not just talking here about some forms and emails. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of lives, in some cases millions of lives, affected by her ineptness. This woman is a war criminal, as far as I'm concerned. But there's a system that protects her. And why? We know the answer. This is America. We know the answer. Time and again, the rules are shown not to apply to the Clintons. They don't have to obey any rules. They have a foundation that has not yet filed an audited statement since 1999, and we have hundreds, in fact, we have billions of dollars unaccounted for. Nobody's investigated them. Why? Because the head of the IRS is a Democrat. The woman who is in charge of the Justice Department is a Democrat. And you know, right after this, for her stellar performance, she may even get appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a rapid crime, a rapid climb, sorry. That was a Freudian slip. It is a crime, what's going on. To have the nerve to come before the people and with a straight face announce that you are invoking your authority and we should therefore believe you because you are the head of the FBI or you're the head of the Justice Department, which means you're not lying. You're truthful and you are correct. You couldn't possibly be corrupt. You couldn't possibly be blocking or impeding justice. You couldn't possibly be carrying out orders given from on high in the Democratic Party. You couldn't possibly be obeying it because you have a vested interest in your future after making an announcement. So ahead of this announcement, in which the FBI pronounced Hillary Clinton the greatest crime she has committed so far, it's just poor judgment. She was careless. She was just careless. That's all. How many times are we going to go down these alleys and come to the same conclusion that Hillary Clinton, you know, it's unfortunate that so many times people have just decided that, you know, for whatever reason, they're just going to investigate her. It's just a form of, you know, this is what she called the right-wing conspiracy. No, you're being investigated because there's strong indication that you are engaged willingly and enthusiastically in wrongdoing. But there is the greater command here. And it, under no circumstances, will tolerate the impugning of the reputation of a white woman in America, not at this level, and certainly not at this time. And that's how it works. That's how it works. I asked all the time, what exactly were her credentials for Secretary of State? She doesn't even speak a foreign language. She's never studied diplomacy. She's never really engaged in preparation for the job, like all other candidates were expected to. No, she is the exception. American exceptionalism. And that's what we have. So today, we have confirmation, not only in the not only of the character of Mrs. Clinton, we have confirmation of the character of the entire process. And it is supposed to be, to us, it should resonate as being way beneath our standard. This is way beneath our standard. And we should reject it. And how do we reject it? We reject all of them. We reject the party. We reject the president. We reject any of the messengers they're sending out to tell us, well, this is the right decision to make. You don't know what is the right decision to make. Evidently, it's so clear. You have no clue about what the right thing to do is. This government has gone to hell in a handbasket, and we are in a period of American history where nobody cares except that they should win at all costs. They have the money, therefore they should have the power. Therefore, shut up and let them do what they want to do. That's where we are. That is the nature of the relationship between those who govern or presume to govern and those who allow them to. So it still comes back to us. The challenge still comes back to us. Are you going to let this happen? Is this really in line with what you anticipate as the reward you get for exercising your civic duty? Is this in line with your interests and your expectations of what the conduct of the system ought to be? So in your face, offensive. I say no. This is the time. We're not hearing from the people who are so moral and who are quick to tell us about the repugnant Republicans. They've shut up. We're not hearing from the great conscious Democrat, people like Elizabeth Warren, people like Bernie Sanders. Oh, no, 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 no. They know when to shut up too. The progressive community is shut up on this one. and checked out. So we left on our own. And since we left on our own, let's act in our own interest and utterly reject this. This is way beneath our standard. It just is perfect for people like Hillary Clinton and her ilk. But we should insist it doesn't nearly qualify as being credible leadership in our eyes and reject them. This is why you have to leave the Democratic Party and do whatever you can to make its existence very, very difficult. Because what it has been doing is spitting in your face. Now, this is not about being particularly bitter. This is what you have to do. This is a political job, a political duty. When people so flagrantly violate your rights and your interests, you have to respond accordingly. They do not deserve anybody's support until this party begins to behave like it understands why it exists. I find this just utterly unacceptable. And all the more so because Hillary Clinton's very existence as a political entity is predicated on the support, blind support, from people who are least able to just afford it. The stakes are very high. She cares nothing about anybody's interests. She cares only about her personal power. And we see everybody falling in line from the president on down. We have reached a definitive point in this country where it doesn't matter how you win, it matters only that you win. Well, okay. Apply the same maxim to yourself. If this system does not rise to your expectation, your job is to make sure it doesn't rise at all. Thanks for being with me today. I really appreciate it, giving the space to stretch out a little bit. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And it's always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. You may be a councilman taking bribes on the side. Working in a barber shop, may know how to cut.